The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the November 23rd, 2013 edition of Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. What gloomy weather I'm experiencing, but we did get some very nice rain here and are supposed to get more, so that makes up for it. I made soup yesterday and still have a big pot full of it. And as far as I'm concerned, it could be a bottomless. It could be bottomless, and I would just keep eating it. Next week is Thanksgiving week. I won't be doing any new shows during this week, this coming week. So you will hear reruns of past great shows. I want to wish all American listeners a happy Thanksgiving of whatever type you most enjoy. Now, in case I don't give myself time to say it at the end of this program, which is usually the case for me, an item from James Sanchez, a science project with legs, is the title of a story in the New York Times from November 5th on page D3. It tells us that Jack Millman, traveling to Israel for his sister's bar mitzvah, wondered whether the high cost of kosher foods were justified. So he collected 213 samples of chicken drumsticks in New York when he returned, I guess. And he bought them from supermarkets, butcher shops, and specialty stores, and found that, tested them all for E. coli, and found that kosher chicken tested almost twice as high as conventional or organic chicken for levels of the antibiotic resistant E. coli, the one that everybody's most afraid of in raw meats and produce and so on. And so he said, turns out that conventional and organic chicken were very similar, but the kosher chicken was almost twice as dangerous. Unsanitary. Well, you know, we know that Jews tend to be kind of dirty. They do. And that's from James Sanchez, as I said. He finds a lot of very interesting little things, but I often would like to talk to him about it. He's a great guy. I asked him to come on this program as a guest, but he doesn't want to do that for, I forget now the reasons, but he's not prepared to do that at the present time, probably for some time. He has a young family and things like that, and he's very busy too. So another item is that I've been getting a lot of mail about last Saturday's interview with Polish historian Peter Zajkowicz and Zajkowicz. And I can tell that listeners would like to go further into this entire topic. And I think I will try to get Peter on again, if he will come on. See, because I'm not sure about that. But I have so many other things to do right now. I can't do the necessary preparation anytime soon, I mean. And the issue, though, of Germany and Poland is one that just doesn't get settled. And is very difficult, and I would like to take it on and try to go further than has been gone so far by most, which I think just kind of we all know how, you know, up to a certain point and then it just stops. You know, we've heard over and over again the stories of how the war started and so on, but anyway, this will have to wait for some future time, it seems to me, right at the moment. And now I'm back into the big art story still underway in Germany and around the world, wherever Jews live, which is everywhere. And I had received an email with some paintings a while back. I'm going to go to that right now. On November 12th, actually, from someone. I don't know whether to say his name. He probably would like me to. Joel Mayer. If he didn't like me to, then it's too late now. And he sent a selection of paintings that I could, you know, look at in large size by Lucian Freud, who is the grandson of Sigmund Freud, who, according to the Guardian newspaper, in 1964, was considered Britain's greatest living painter. Well, now that he's dead, I wonder what his rating is. Probably he's certainly not considered the greatest British painter, but I had, these are really shocking paintings, and he sent me the most shocking that probably exists of this man's work. And I had seen them before, but I had totally forgotten about them. And this brought it all to mind. And I didn't think I had any reason to talk about them, but now today I'm going to mention it a little bit. Because these are what you might say the result of what modern art started back in the time that the paintings that we're going to, you know, that are talked about in this art scandal in Germany right now, in the early part of the 20th century, and it is now what we have is just the intent to shock as much as possible. You know, those paintings back then were considered shocking. Because they were distorted, because they didn't use color in any kind of natural way. Well, they didn't draw things in a naturalistic way. You know, they took actually inspiration in large part from primitive art, trying to get something that was going to shock the public out of their comfortable little space. You know, their bourgeois. They hated the bourgeoisie. And they needed to do something about that. And as time went on and the whole idea was to come up with something new, then it came back to figurative painting again, but in ways of showing nudes in a rather harsh, realistic light rather than as beautiful images. Often it was, you know, real strong lighting, strong shadows, blatant, you know, poses of nudes. But now, with this man, it is featuring the genitals and the buttocks and so on in ways that are, it's like you're going into somebody's, home or, and just seeing them without, you know, them knowing you're there in their private, their private habits and just watching it all. You know, it's really sickening. Anyway, the fact that this Lucian Freud is Jewish and is the grandson of Sigmund Freud should not be lost on anyone. But, I just Googled Lucian Freud paintings before the show started. So I was just doing that when it was time to get on the air. And I came up with this article in The Guardian from 2004, before he died. Sometime after that, he has died. It says, Freud is notable not only for Lucian Freud is notable not only for his prodigious output. At any one time, he will be at work on five or six paintings and perhaps an etching, but for the intense way in which he scrutinizes his subjects. If you look him up, you know, you'll get an idea of what I mean. Although what was right there available were not the worst ones that this emailer sent me. But they're pretty weird. And, one of them is there though, which is called, Sunny Morning -Eight Legs. This was painted in 1997. And it's an example of his more disgusting type. He also has some super, super fat, gross females laying around. Well, there's two of them here, and then there's one with two females, two lesbian females, sleeping together. One of them looks like she's pregnant. Really gross stuff, you know, intending to be gross. So I'll just continue reading this, and I'll go on with a little bit of my own review. What I thought was funny was it says that his sitters must be present even when only the background is being painted. He had a sitter for all of his paintings. And this one man, Dawson, who is the subject actually of this article in the Guardian, who was his assistant. And then he was an art student, you know, had been an art student, and he painted himself. And so now he's getting more well known as a painter. So it mentions him here, says Dawson has firsthand experience of this. Well, Dawson also functioned as a model, and he was the model for this Sunday morning eight legs painting, with him laying there as if asleep with his head thrown back, his legs open, his genitals, you know, flopping around there. And he's just looking very repulsive, and he's got this dog in his arms who's sleeping peacefully on this rumpled up bed. And then underneath, which I hadn't seen until I hadn't seen what this guy sent me. Maybe I didn't scroll down far enough, but I just now saw that this painting is kind of deep, more deep than it is wide, and it under the bed, two kind of sprawly legs are sticking out from under the bed, male legs. It's just repulsive. And supposedly, they say he sat for that painting. You know, he didn't sit. He laid. He lay down in a bed and, you know, in that pose. And then he posed for those legs coming out from under the bed also. So it's just what else does it say here that's any good? He's gonna, in this new exhibition that was gonna come up for Freud, he's gonna have two more portraits of his assistant, a head, and if it is ready in time, another naked painting with his whippet dog. He likes to paint naked people, male and female, holding dogs, which are very, you know, passive and relaxed looking. So, what have I got written here? Okay, that goes to something else. All right, so the point I was making was how, you know, they're so proper in this. They take this stuff so seriously. And they call all these paintings where these naked people are sprawled around as sitting for the painting. You know, like you used to sit for a portrait. Well, they call it sitting. And this super fat woman definitely looks like the same woman in both paintings. So it probably, since he insists on having a model for all of his, he did insist on having a model for all of his art, he must have found this woman and had her pose for him. That's just a lead up to, I want to thank Joel Mayer for sending that in. That's just a lead up to the idea of what has happened to art, you know. And this is totally acceptable today. And if you can go into famous and important, what are considered important national art museums all over the world today, and you will, in some of them, you will find a painting by Lucian Freud, one of these paintings. I don't know who has one exhibited, one of these more blatant pornographic types, but I bet they do, because they're considered great and highly valuable. So as much as the German National Socialists managed to pry away from Jews so much of their ill-gotten wealth, power, and prestige, the Jews are gaining it all back with their well-known voracious desire, appetite, and coordinated networking energy. And that's the way I see what's going on in this latest little art hoard that's been found, that they call it the art cache, that's been in the news. And you know, the Gentile elites are helping them every step of the way, because they want to be in the art world too, and the only way to be in the art world is to go along with what with the Jewish narrative about it, and the entire Jewish narrative. And so in truth, the art world today belongs to Jews, and it has for quite a long time. But Jews have made what is ugly to be called great, and I don't know if they call it beautiful, but they call it, you know, fantastic and brilliant and works of genius and so on. And they have caused what is evil to be called good, and of course they call good evil. They have the most incompetent. They have caused also the most incompetent to be the most admired. Well, I can tell that this Lucian Freud was a good painter as far as handling paint and doing what he wanted to do with it. That is what is admired. But his subject matter is accepted, because no matter how insulting and what would you call it, where you insult people with it, no matter how much it is that way, that is acceptable, you know, because that's what artists are supposed to do now. So you know, and you know, Jews have never been artists, but a lot of Jews are now, have become artists in this day and age. But they didn't used to, because making images and likenesses was forbidden for them, and they never developed an ability to make a likeness, and they don't like making likenesses now. But a lot of or they're not very good at it either. But a lot of what you might say integrated Jews today, like probably this Lucian Freud is, have thrown all that over, and they have learned how to make likenesses too. But the Christian world, on the other hand, back when, revered and adored images of their religious figures and so on, biblical figures and sacred figures. And so they made images of them, and, you know, looked to the image for remind teaching, for the church was actually teaching the people who couldn't read, or there was no reading or writing for them or anything, teaching them the stories of the Bible and so on through imagery and pictures. So making images was an industry for a long time in the Christian world. And there was admiration for those who excelled in this. It was part of our culture, and the ideal of the artist was always present. You know, then the ability of artists to create likenesses grew to astounding levels during the what we call the Renaissance, and before that, leading up to it, as European artists discovered the secrets of perspective and atmospheric effects, and how to show them in paint and so on, which had not been done previously. Well, that was a great leap forward in art, and that was all done by European, what we'd call Christian artists in the white Christian culture of Europe. And Jews were left out of that altogether and didn't have any interest in it. But when they did decide to move into taking over everything of ours, they set out to demean all that we valued in art by declaring a new art, which was based on mental rather than visual concepts, and declared talent in making likenesses as belonging to the dead past, really, and no longer stimulating to the modern mind, that is no longer it was something that was done back then, but doesn't need to continue to be done. So they're looking for new ways to make art. And so that's what see what else I want to say about that is that I guess I'm going right into the art cache now, the latest stories on this that have come up. Is that they have now released more of these paintings from this so-called Gurlitt collection. And I was looking through them yesterday, and it is I figured that most of them were going to be little sketches, little drawings, little prints, not that big and not that important, because as you have to remember that when something is a graphic print, it's done on some base, and then paper is applied to it. I mean, ink and so on of one kind or another, and paper is applied, and you make an image of it on the paper of what you've got on your original, and then you can make many of them. When you have prints, you have them in editions, and they might have limited editions, so there wouldn't be more than say 50. That would be a moderate one, or you could make as many as you wanted, actually, hundreds. And so, but these are art prints, so they're supposed to be distinguishable from commercial lithography. But still, a print is not an original in the sense of it's the only one that exists. There's others of it. That's why they never get as expensive as paintings. And so that takes down the value, it seems to me, of this collection, although there's some paintings in it that they have ridiculous prices on it, but I've talked about that before, so I'm not going to spend time on that. But one of the, I was looking them over and at the sizes, and their sizes are given in centimeters. And one of the drawings by the Jew Max Liebermann, there's a lot of them by him, and he wasn't great at all, but he was a impressionist. He followed the impressionist school, which is a lot more tolerable and seems a lot more very normal and natural today to the general public. They're very accepting of impressionism and think it's just fine, you know, like it, in fact, appreciate it very much. It's some of it's better than other, but it's not at the level of the classical artists, but this Max Liebermann had some good paintings. You know, all artists, if you do enough work, some of it looks pretty darn good, and some of it is average, and some of it didn't work out at all, and I've mentioned that before too. So a lot of these small things are just little like doodles that the artist is doing, just little idea things. You know, there's nothing more. I mean, they would just throw them away, but if they keep them around in their studio, then somebody comes along and buys a whole bunch of the stuff for some price, you know, and so they're happy to sell it. I mean, that's the way I look at it. And to think that most of this work was sold under duress and they didn't get what it was worth is just ridiculous when you see what it is, what so much of it is. Of course, they've only shown now, they have about, what did I figure? 80, eight pages of 10 each. And that includes what's already been revealed. So we don't see that much more so far. But I guess it's going to be coming. And there's going to be 500 and some that we're going to see. But this, I've looked for the smallest ones. One of these drawings by Max Liebermann is only 3 by 5 inches. Think about that. And it's nothing. It's just he just scribbled around, you know, some idea of some trees or something. And I mean, it's actually not, you know, I thought it was pretty terrible. But what are you going to do on 3 by 5 inches? I mean, it wasn't a serious effort. And another one is under 4 by 4 inches both ways. You know, it's four by four. And it's just like a little doodling. And so I won't go on that. And then there's more of his like that. Then there's a print of a female nude by Ludwig Godenschweig. And you wouldn't know, if you didn't know the actual size of it, you would think it was a, you know, regular type of size, but it's It's 2.9 inches by 1.8 inches. Now, that's really getting tiny. And it's a print, too. How can you work so small? I don't know. That's that. Now, this the latest story I'm going to give the highlights of that has come out about this that I think is interesting is that this a scholarly task force has been set up, led by prominent German art historian Uwe Hartmann, and it's going to include two so-called experts, they call them experts, from the Jewish Claims Conference. So this Uwe Hartmann sounds all right. He looks very German, nice guy, nice smile on his face. He runs in Germany the Center for Provenance Investigation and Research at the Institute for Museum Research of the Berlin State Museums hyphen Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation. So he's a recognized authority on provenance research, that is investigating the who originally owned it. I mean, and you know, who the painting or the work of art has passed through which hands, you know, to get where it is, you know, what the background of it is. He's okay. He's described as scientific director now for this task force, and he's responsible for shedding light on the darkness of the case, which is being followed by art lovers around the world for the past 2 weeks. Yeah. Earlier this month, he already publicly stated his own position about the art, and he said, "In many cases, we're not dealing with art looted by the Nazis. Aha. And we must therefore act on the assumption Mr. Gurlitt is lawfully in possession of this property." Well, you know, the Jews did not like that. And they came right out and started criticizing him for making such a statement so early. And the lawyers for the families of the Nazi victims, have been criticizing the authorities for keeping this find secret for 2 years. And I just say, you know, when are Jews and their spokesmen not criticizing something that white people are doing? When are they not, particularly what the Germans are doing, but really what anybody's doing when they think that something should be under their control or in their hands? And then they come out and say, no, this, they say this. The writers of the article, this particular article was in Der Spiegel, but it has the latest news in it. And they say, or he or she says, in a country that has worked so hard to become a model student, remorseful and willing to learn, facing up to its Nazi past, and compensating the victims, it is now threatened to have a serious setback by what's going on here. See, this is how they push and try to push and pressure Germans into doing what they want. And I forget who wrote this. I think it might have been somebody with a Jewish name. Anyway, to go on though with what's important here, I'm losing myself. Okay, I went too far. So Germany's supposed to be remorseful, and they're supposed to cave in allow the Jews to control what's happening and to make them happy so they won't be criticizing poor little German. And the team here, though, is made up of delegates, Okay. Oh, sorry about this. I've got some of it looking as important, the rest not, and I'm having trouble making sense from a delegate from I don't know why this is important, but there are officials on this task force from the Berlin Commission for Culture and Media, BKM. And oh, I know why I made that important, because this woman, oh geez, keeps missing my mark here. Ay, ay, ay. This woman from this BK. I'll get there. This woman from this BK. M. Berlin Commission for Culture and Media is somebody named. Mikey Hoffman. No, she's not. She's this other woman. Lawyer, Ingeborg Berggren Merkel. I've left too much of this in here. The lawyer, Ingeborg Berggren Merkel. She's a character. I saw a picture of her. She got this real arty looking scarf on, and she's got this weird face, an ugly, ugly woman's face, you know, for the typical kind of woman that you know, gets into things like this. They love art, but they themselves are so unattractive. And anyway, she is, she has forced herself onto this, and some of this is not as important as I thought when I was reading it. She has forced herself onto this, and she is one who is announcing, she announced that the prosecutor's office will publish all the images of the paintings, and she said that okay, well, you know, I can't find what I was going to say about her, but there's her, and then there's this Mikey Hoffman, who's been there with the prosecutor's office from the beginning. She seems to be a decent person. Anyway, Hartman is the academic head of this task force, and once again, what's important is that he has actually come out and said that that it probably 300 or so, somebody has, that 300 or so of these paintings probably belong to Cornelius Gurlitt. I don't know why I'm so confused here. They probably belong to Cornelius Gurlitt. He will probably get them back. Oh, that's a far cry from the 1,280 that he started with. But, you know, as soon as this is announced, the Jews start complaining, and I just can't seem to find where I've got that, but they start criticizing what's being done, and they don't want it. They say it's too soon to decide that, and he should not be saying that. But it's also true that it has been said that Gurlitt has not been accused of committing any crime. So he's not, they have no reason to withhold his property from him. Now, they just keep repeating themselves here. This commission is tasked with ascertaining the labyrinth history of every single one of the 570 paintings and whether they belong to Jews or other victims of the Nazis, which is a huge task. And actually, you know, they say whether they belong to Jews or other victims of the Nazis. Why don't they just say whether they belong to victims of the Nazis? But they can't ever do that, you see, because they've got Jews in control here, writing and editing, or they are know that the Jews insist on this or whatever. So they always have to mention the Jews. But so what they're saying is that this is going to do this right, it's going to take a long time. And the Jews are just pushing for this urgency so that all this research probably would not get done. They'll just respond to these lawyers' demands when these people say that these paintings belong to them. I don't know, but it's, you know, it seems to me that maybe what's behind it is they see an opportunity to harass and yell at Germany and criticize the Germans for what they're doing and tie Germans in with present day Germans in with Nazis and make these Germans freak out, these German politicians and officials and so on freak out that they're being associated with being soft or on Nazism and so forth, or behaving like Nazis, and they, you know, they can't stand that, so that's how they push them into doing what they want to do. And this working group has existed for 10 years, but they say that it's more likely it will take the task force years rather than months to identify what could possibly be looted art in Gerlich's collection, and that each case is unique and every picture is different. So this whole media scandal calling the discovery of art Nazi loot is atrocious in itself, because right off the bat, but we know they do this all the time, right off the bat, they, because of the time that it was, it disappeared, and it has been held since that time, they came up with this Nazi looted art thing without any proof about it, just, you know, it's possible or suppositions, and plastered it all over the media. And now that's identified with people. And now they're going to go through this long process of trying to determine what the real origins of it were. And when they find out that there wasn't much looted by Nazis, then that will be, nobody will be listening to this story anymore by that time. Probably. If they even get to that point. Because the Jewish Claims Conference has forced its way onto this commission. They've got two members there, and they are pushing for a quick restitution of Jewish property lost during the Holocaust. Of course, their whole thing is about the Holocaust, and they really have no business being on that commission, but they insist that this is all property stolen during the Holocaust, so therefore it has to do with that. Well, it could be, you know, it was during that time, but in any case, they say that they have to have Jewish victims represented. And they also say that some 100 lawyers have already registered their interest with the public prosecutor's office. And they have not received any answers. 100 lawyers are already clamoring to the officials in Germany. And do you think they're all Jewish lawyers? At least they're all representing Jews. So that's in my estimation a good sign that they're not totally caving into this, and that we might find out where this art really did come from. And also, I'm glad we're going to see it all, because I'm sure already there's so much crap in there. And I don't know that most people are probably not interested in looking at them, particularly when they get to these little black and white things, but without famous names on them. But people who understand art will be interested in looking at them, and who are interested in art. So that this should shed some more light. But another story that was good was this reporter who spent 4 days with Cornelius Gerlich. And she says that she describes what kind of a man he is. And I think I like this guy. He is not a modern man at all. He has what the points that she made. She stayed in the same building that he was in. I don't know if it was where he lives or they put him in a hotel for a while, and she, you know, paid for his meals and so on. And, she was able to talk with him quite a bit on those days, but she says she spent 4 days with him. And she said he's the kind of man who books hotel rooms by mail and only writes his things on a typewriter and signs everything with a fountain pen, and that he marvels at why telephones show numbers on display screens, that he last went to the movies in 1967, where he saw Franz Josef Spiecker's Wild Rider, LLC, one of the first works of the new German cinema. I guess he didn't want to see any more after that. He talks about that movie as if it were yesterday, she says. Well, I guess he liked it. It was a comedy, and it made him laugh, he said. But he never went again, according to him. And he doesn't use the internet. He doesn't own a television. He does collect newspaper articles, preferably colorful ones, and he listens to the radio. So he enjoys his own collections, you know, whether his art collection or things that he cuts out from the newspaper. And now here I think is interesting. I think the man is totally honest in telling the truth about himself. I don't think he's a con man. He's too simple. He's too backwards, really, to be doing that. He's a typical, I don't know if he's typical, but he's definitely a recluse type of person. He doesn't hurt anybody, you know, and he takes care of himself. He's, in the pictures you see of him, he looks quite clean and orderly. His hair is cut. His clothes look nice. And his cousin, who lives in Spain, was it, that they've interviewed, who looks like a real weirdo, you know, with lots of beads and stuff hanging around his neck. He said that whenever Cornelius came to visit or they met, he was always dressed very well. He was always polite. He always behaved himself very properly. You know, that's how he was brought up, and that's how he has remained. And because he said that he was, he really resented this, what he heard on the radio when they reported that the paintings they took from his apartment were stored among canned food and leftovers. And he says that was not the case. And he said that, sure, he has plenty of food on the shelves at home, but that's because he was following the federal government's responding to the German federal government's squirrel campaign of 1961, when people were encouraged to stockpile food like squirrels do for the winter. So he probably had a lot of canned food that he never did eat or use. It was still there from 1961, but he didn't throw it out, and wouldn't have been anything rotting, and I don't know about the leftovers, if they may have gone in there, you know, when he was in the process of living. They went in the morning, and there was some food sitting around in the kitchen, so they say that, as though the man lived, you know, like a real slob. Anyway, he says he resented that, and that he doesn't trust, well, she says this, that he doesn't trust anyone, but he's distraught because he doesn't understand why the state is publicly displaying his private property. He doesn't like that. He doesn't like to see it all displayed like this, because he's kept it like secretive all this time. So for him, it should be, you know, it shouldn't be shown around like that. And of course, again, what I've said before, it's what he loves the most in the world. And she says that I guess she took him into a bakery while they were together for a warm croissant and probably some coffee or something, or tea, for a little, you know, sit down. And she said he was eating this, really enjoying this croissant, and kept saying that it was the best he's eaten in ages. And that his favorite meal is a ready-made, this is funny, his favorite meal is a ready-made chicken fricassee from Karstadt, a German department store. So there he has got all this millions of dollars worth of art in his possession. But he just lives very modestly and plainly, and doesn't indulge or waste any money on anything. It doesn't have expensive tastes either. You know, now they're doing all this, making him into a criminal. And I think the Germans are starting to realize, what they've done and what's happened and that, and who this man probably really is and that he's not really going to be guilty of anything. And so they're trying to, straighten it out a little bit. And I just trust that some of these people like this, Uwe Hartman will do the right thing in the end. And here's another thing about this Cornelius Gurlitt. He raves. He told this reporter that was with him that he raves. She said he raves about former Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. And he said, in contrast to Angela Merkel, Adenauer never went to soccer games in a public manner. And a quote from him, Adenauer would never have taken a government plane to watch a football match in South Africa. He says stadiums are evil places, all about victory. He said, I can swear on the Bible that I've never been to a stadium. And she said he seemed to be very proud of that and laughed self-consciously after he said it. Anyway, it has, there's also been, which I didn't talk about before, but a letter that has been uncovered by, it wasn't really a secret, just nobody had been looking at it. Hildebrand Gurlitt wrote a letter in November of 1955 in which he talked about his, after he had been investigated and so on by the Allies and by the Americans, and finally they sent his most of his collection back to him and exonerated him, and he still felt that there was this mark of, you know, on him. So he wrote this kind of a letter. I don't know if it was a letter to an editor or what, but it's kind of long, in which he explained his life, you know, and how it really was and why he was an innocent man. And he said some interesting things here. He said, my father was a man whose home was frequented by young artists like Ernst Ludwig Kirchner. He was one of those German expressionists. And these were real Germans, not Jews. And Carl Schmidt Rottluff and Erich Haeckel, in short, the founders of the Dresden it means the bridge, group of German expressionist artists. And they were kind of, wild and with color and with their distortions of the figures and so on, and the simplicity, the simplifying of their work. I think they probably wanted to paint like that. They probably thought that was, something new and different and expressed some feelings in them from the time. This was the time around, you know, during World War I and in between. But De Bruyck was one of the first of these new art movements that are noted in art history as being meaningful. And it was probably then, you know, inspired by, in large part, by World War I and all the terrible kind of things that were going on. But still, it was the Jews who bought their work, I think, and the Jews who promoted it, and the Jews who wanted work like that. I mean, it could have been that nobody ever bought their work or was interested in it, and it just faded away, and nobody ever cared about it. But it was promoted, and this by Jews, and this Hildebrand Gurlitt, who was part Jewish, said he saw the first exhibition of the Brucke in a Baroque lamp shop on a desolate street in Dresden around 1912, and that these barbaric, passionately powerful colors, this rawness enclosed in the poorest of wooden frames, aimed to hit the middle class like a slap in the face. That's what he said. And this is where you get the, where you really get the, you know, the insight into it, that they they felt alienated from so much. They saw the bourgeoisie as allowing so much that was wrong to go on, which was true. They wanted to be very, very, well, revolutionary. They wanted to be very, very different from that. They wanted to totally reject it all. So they painted this way, and they met together and talked about it and gave each other courage and ideas. And so they all, you know, kept going with this kind of thing. So they were probably basically sincere, but it was anti, well, you know, it was an anti type of, art. And anyway, this Gerlich goes on to say that is indeed what it did. It just shocked you and felt like it was meant to be a huge put down, but not in a joke way, but in a serious way of the bourgeois society and the middle class of the time. That's what it was meant to be. And he said that, he was surprised that his mother said that, they should buy one of these interesting works. And she took one home, a woodcut. And, then his father, who was in the arts in some way, told him that these young painters were excellent people, and it may very well be that this art will become as important to your life as the struggle over Hans Thoma, Arnold Böcklin, and Max Liebermann was in his time. Well, Max Liebermann goes back pretty far then. Of course, Max Liebermann died in 1936 or so, and he was, you know, at least in his 70s, if not his 80s. So he's of that little bit earlier time when Germans were maybe, I'm not familiar with these other two right off the bat. I didn't look them up. But it was, he said that it was at this time, during his time, earlier, that the Bauhaus was booted out of, no, I guess this is, Hildebrand Gerlich is saying that at the time that his mother bought this painting, it was at this time that Bauhaus was booted out of Weimar. And, anyway, after a few semesters teaching, and let me go on and get through this, in his essay here, he goes on to talk about what he did, Hildebrand Gerlich, what he did in his life, and how he got kicked out of his job at the Dresden State Academy of Art because of the increasingly powerful Nazi Party. And then this was fairly early on, but he says that they were so powerful enough to have him kicked out. And then he says he became director of a new institution in Hamburg. And after working there successfully, he was sacked again in 1932. This time it was because of strong Nazi influence, and they didn't like him and the kind of art that he was pushing. And he said, but he was able to continue there in Germany, and he opened a kind of a gallery in his house. And he thinks he did a great job of allowing normal citizens. This is what he calls them. He went against public opinion of the time, which was in the spirit of the National Socialists, and allowed normal citizens to give free rein to their innate hate of the good art that was blowing apart their cozy world. So his position was that the citizens who liked this new art were normal. And this was good art, but it was blowing apart the cozy world of the normal citizens, which would be the bourgeoisie. And this was what it was intended to do. I have some more here, but I don't have it bolded out. So he's just exonerating himself and saying that he tried to help the artists, this kind of art, and he, as the best he could, you know, and he doesn't really go in. There's a page missing, and they say that there's an entire page missing, which was which would have fit in his letter to the time that he was working for the Nazis, it said. And that page is missing. Now, why is that page missing? There's no answer to that so far, but it is. Whether he or somebody else removed it, I don't know. But one more thing about this. Let's see, I've got 4 minutes or so. Maybe I can do it before the break. That, or here's where it just says that he's likely to get 300 of his pictures back. And the Jews really are unhappy about that. Jewish groups accuse authorities of seeking to hastily end the scandal with this move of saying that that he's not that he's the owner of these 300 pictures, at least 300 of these. And this guy, well, I didn't make it. This guy told the Süddeutsche Zeitung that 310 paintings were undoubtedly Görlitz's legitimate property and could be returned to him by next week. The Central Council of Jews in Germany criticized the move, as and they said, after the whole thing was treated almost conspiratorially for more than 18 months, the quick decision of a wholesale return of the art is certainly also the wrong way. Well, they want the art that they think belongs to Jews returned right away, as soon as possible. But they don't want these paintings that definitely belong to Görlitz to be returned as soon as possible. And Ronald Lauder of the World Jewish Conference also got in and made his statements. So that's where we stand today, ladies and gentlemen, with this interesting story. And we'll see what comes up in the future. Be back in 5 minutes.
Erinnert an deine Qual. Keiner kommt mehr hierher, niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so sehe. Treuer Soldat, merkt dein namenloses Grab. Ich wünschte, ich hätte ein Gespräch. Du Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Mit dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich. Ungebrochener Held, ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedanke zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer da noch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld ihr beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand. Ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Es ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Ihr habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht. Für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Doch ich höre deine Stimme. Ich glaub, du mich sprichst. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen. Ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich höre eine Stimme, zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und bis an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn, Saturday afternoon with Carolyn Yeager, and it is November 23rd today, and we're closing in on Thanksgiving week. Before I get into the court testimony of Uwe Bonhart's mother, I mean, I just have a little bit I want to say about that. I'm just going to mention this news story from Germany, which does show the kind of things that the direction that things are going there, and why we have the situations like with this art cache that we have, and that is news that German companies that are listed on the stock exchange are going to have to have at least 30% of their supervisory board members to be female beginning in 2016, according to proposed legislation. But this legislation is being proposed by Angela Merkel's conservative bloc, which is the majority, and the Social Democrats, she's bringing in as her coalition partners. So the Social Democrats, this is something they've been pushing, and on their egalitarian agenda. So Merkel's parties are going along with that, and it will probably be voted in. And what it is, they complain that women still earn less than men in daily working life. And they barely have opportunities to get into leadership positions. And that's why this was the woman representing labor, the labor minister, said, we agreed on legally binding rules on equal pay for equal work and for women in leadership positions. And in order to help that along, they have to make this 30% rule. But they explain here that that in Germany the companies have a two-tier board structure, and they have a managing board and a management board, which works with the chief executive and runs the day-to-day operations. And then they have a supervisory board, which is similar to the United States Board of Directors. So it's just so far the supervisory board that has to be 30% female. Or will have to be once the time is reached, and not yet the other one, because they probably don't want to destroy German business quality and, you know, make too many changes too fast and hurt their economy. So, that's why they're doing this. But, you know, it's just part of the destruction of white families and, the encouragement of women to think of themselves as competing with men in the workplace and being like men in the workplace. And if you're going to be in that kind of a high-powered, you know, corporate workplace, you have to be very devoted to it. And this idea, and I've even said this in the past, that women can do both. But, you know, when you think about the mindset that's required, if you're going to be competing in this way and working in this atmosphere, you're not going to be thinking at all like a mother or in any maternal sense. You can't have your children on your mind. The best you can do is to fit in having a kid or two and then, you know, sending them to the daycare that they have so much of there in Germany and, letting them sending them to school and, you know, looking after them, but not really being there for them in the same way that, women, mothers used to be there, and which is very, very good for children. And I had that. I was lucky enough to have that. So this is just part of that destruction of our race, really. So that, and it's not only going to be, as this continues, it's not only going to be white women who get these opportunities, but it's all women. And there's less, more and more non-white women. So all of this is, you know, all of this is going to go to these non-white people, all of these benefits and taking, having power in the society in the sense of, being the employed in the high level companies and so on. The other thing they're going to do is, well, just the other thing I was going to say, oh, she said, but the negotiators didn't, however, agree on a position for same-sex marriage and the adoption of children by same-sex couples. So, this was, Merkel's party opposes this still, but it would be the left-leaning social, they call it that, the left social democrats that are pushing now for, to make it more liberal for same-sex marriages and adoption of children for same-sex couples. Yuck. They call the Merkel's Christian Democratic Union center-right. Well, it's, you know, it's not very right. It's more like center. And then they call the social democrats left-leaning. Well, they're not just left-leaning, they're left. But of course they save the word left for the communists. The outright communists are the left. And so then the social democrats have to be called center-left. And all of these designations are just not accurate. So, going on to the NSU process trial, which is moving very slowly, there's a couple of points I want to make before I talk about the mother of this so-called terrorist. And that is that it's moving very slowly, and there's hardly any news in the English language. And there's not that much in the German language either, because I was looking for it. And just a tiny bit more. Or they just write more stories, but they spread it out. And when they write one in English, they put it all together in there. So they just write them less often. But she had made the point that her son in 1990, this was in the German, but was not in the English article. Her son in 1995 or 96 brought a girlfriend home. And this is Uwe Bunhardt, and the girlfriend was Beta Schappa, and Bridget, his mother, Uwe's mother, was very happy that he had a girlfriend, and she thought, she immediately liked Beta Schappa. She was polite and nice, And nothing she said hinted at any right-wing attitude. Even at family gatherings, she was behaving as just one of the family. And then about this Seska pistol, which I've talked about before, which is really, you know, this is supposed to be such damning evidence. But they found this pistol in the fire debris of the apartment in Zwickau, it says, that the three of them had together. And in November 2011, so I had asked the question last time I talked about this, if this was the exact same gun or just the same model of gun. Well, it is just the same model of gun. Supposedly these people, well, I guess they proved that these people were killed by bullets from a Seska pistol, just like the one that they found in the apartment. But it wasn't, there's no way to prove that it's the same, exact same one. So that's not as strong, but it's pretty strong, as circumstantial evidence goes. And then they make a big thing out of this silencer. And they will say that, if they bought a pistol with a silencer. But it's been already testified to. And then they kind of want to ignore it or show it differently in the news articles. But, of course, in the court, they can't. They know. They know that. It's been testified to that they didn't, the two boys didn't ask for a pistol with a silencer. They just asked for a German-made pistol with ammunition. And when the person who was going to get looked into getting one for them went to see what was available, there was what was available was that a Seska pistol with a silencer. And so that's what they ended up with. Not that they had said that they wanted that. But that makes it sound like, well, they were going to do all this shooting close up, which is these people were shot close up, and they needed a silencer. But they hadn't asked for a silencer in the beginning. Now, another thing that's interesting is that the defense pay, one of the defense lawyers has asked for more money, and he says, I'm just going to read this, he's received only about 5,000 euros as an advance and not the required amount of approximately 77,000 euros. Says he could mount and he, so that, he can't mount an adequate defense. The defense attorneys for Chapa, there's three of them. One of them is this Wolfgang Stahl. The other male is Wolfgang, I think his name is Wolfgang too, Wolfgang here. And they see Judge Kuchenbauer, not the Judge Gürtel, but another judge, as biased, and that they have not, only Wolfgang Stahl has so far submitted an application for an advance, but they made a motion a second time for bias against this judge, and they criticized that he did not say the truth about the meeting of the Senate. I thought I knew what that meant, but I can't think of it right now. But it has to do with this, their pay, and they accused Judge Kuchenbauer of trying to hold their defense short of the required activities and a disciplined approach by not allowing them to have, not approving their money requests, and they would need to consider whether to exercise their defense with almost their full workforce, which they have been using, or would no longer work so intensively in violation of criminal procedures, criminal procedural obligations. They say, they're saying that this violates criminal procedure obligations, that they have to allow the attorneys for the defense, and even when they're court-appointed, well, it is for court-appointed attorneys, because the state pays the court-appointed attorneys, and the state has to pay them enough so that they can do an adequate job of defending the person. This is a part of their law. And they said they have to learn their livelihood, and if they will need to focus on other cases in order to do so, if they don't get what they're supposed to be getting. and he referred to the extensive documentary material that they have to deal with and read through and be familiar with, which already in August 2012 covers approximately 730 folders. That was over a year ago. And this lawyer said as pure work, he had given a he'd spent a total of 756 hours and 17 minutes so far. See how these lawyers figure out their time? 17 minutes. They probably push a timer when they start working on this on the case and push it when they quit, and then it automatically, or it gets added up, and it comes out to something with minutes in it. And that he, I'm not going to read that sentence. In addition, he also cited his significant time constraints, which is now a negative impact on their monthly income. So, and this is like in Nuremberg, makes me think of, where the war criminals who were on trial, their lawyers, their defense attorneys had very poor cooperation from the court. And the same thing seems to always go on, and this is going on here, where these lawyers are saying they're not being given what they're supposed to be given to do the to do their job right. And the they say that there's a word here I don't know what it means, so I'm going to skip that. But the defense attorney of Ralph Wohlleben, who is the one who was a member of the NPD, has a joined them in this and agrees on these points, they call it a rejection request. I don't know what that is there, but anyway, there, that's what's going on there. And the only other thing that's new is that Uwe Boonhardt's mother expressed got on the stand for 2 days of testimony. This is from November 20th. And they wrote a nasty kind of a hit piece editorial portraying her as not as a bad person, you know, because she didn't behave as she should have behaved as she was giving her testimony. And she didn't express sympathy for the victims of her son's alleged crimes. And she thanked Beda Chapa for informing her and her family of her son's death, which she got a phone call. She had gotten a phone call from Chapa that following morning telling her that her son was dead. And she appreciated that. And so, you know, they're criticizing her for thanking the terrorist criminal and not commiserating and not apologizing enough to the Turkish families. And, you know, all in all, I'll just reiterate here that these two guys and these people and the people now on trial who are accused of being accessories to the crimes are accused of 10 murders, 14 armed robberies, and the creation of the National Socialist Underground Terrorist Cell. They insist on calling it that. I'm trying to find more people who are a part of it because they've only got these three. So, and then they make the point, this is the kind of press thing that goes on, that any mother who loses a child, it has a right to grieve for her child. But some might argue that it is worse for her even than for the Turkish families, given that when children die having committed murders, it also always sends a message to the parents. And then that's followed by the heading of the next section. Why did our child do that? They're trying to put blame here again that they did a bad job and they have a bad child and must reflect on them. And while she was testifying, this head judge Manfred Gutzel had a stony face and didn't look very happy with what she was saying. And they call her comments outrageous and not the kind of thing normally heard in a democratic court. Even if one makes allowances for her as a grieving mother. And she said she made little effort to play down the conspiracy theories, which she outlined to the court. You know, she is a woman who is from East Germany, and her family and a lot of those people in the town where she lives, and in that area, are a little bit, don't trust the West German government, or now all the German, the government over them. They don't, they have more nationalistic feelings. They don't really like a lot of what's going on in Germany. They're not the kind of people that this kind of a court favors. And she didn't try to cover that up too much. You know, she just didn't, I'm glad she didn't. She said that, her child, she kind of made excuses for him, because it appears that he was something of a troubled child, and that he had trouble in school, and then he was kicked out of school, and he had some juvenile, you know, law problems, and she said that he was unlucky enough to have hit puberty during the unstable reunification period in his home city of Jena in the former East Germany. Well, there's a lot of strong feelings during that time, that's for sure. But anyway, you can't make those kind of excuses. But she's just saying that, you know, she said it was a bad time for the family when he was having all of his problems and troubles. And, but she says the system is partly to blame, which they don't like to hear. And then she said that, he eventually got an apprenticeship in construction, and she said that was fine with her, and someone has to build houses for the rich and the beautiful. And then, they bought him a car. So she's definitely, although she's a teacher, but she's definitely a working class. She aligns herself in the working class, and has maybe some of that leftover communist idea about the elites who have everything, you know, and the working people don't. And that seems to be a part of the thinking around that area. And they bought Uwe a car, and they paid for driving lessons for him. And after that, he became unemployed. And then he found new friends, among whom were this Ralph Wohlleben and Uwe Mundlos, his partner, and Beate Schappe. And they were all unemployed, Mrs. Bunhart said. And that he did stay for a while in an adult remand center while he was still technically a minor, and she's afraid that they would put him in a real prison, and she had bad ideas about what would happen to a young person like himself in prison. And she said she was, the prosecutors gave her a lot of threatening, frightening ideas about what could happen to her son, how many years, he could get 10 years, and that scared her very much. And she made the comment in court, not even pedophiles who kill children get that. So they consider that inappropriate for her to have said that. And she said that she knew that after being in juvenile authority or whatever, that he would never allow himself to be arrested again. And so this is what, now the thing is, the the public prosecutors, I mean, the police say that they found bomb equipment in the garage where, which was owned by Beta Chapa, turns out now, that they went to after they had searched his mother's garage. And then they went to this other garage and he had a car in it. And, he said that they were searching in that garage. And he said could he leave? He was going to drive off. He had to go somewhere or something. And they said, all right. And he drove that car out of the garage and took off. And it was after that that they say that they found this bomb equipment and so on. Well, if they were doing a search there and he was under suspicion, why would they allow him to leave? And, maybe they couldn't hold him. And maybe he knew that they were going to find this stuff there, so he wanted to get out of there, because that's when he went underground. He went directly from there to his friend Uy Mundlos and Chapa, and the three of them went off and hid and, you know, went underground. And then they say they found this stuff there. Well, I don't know, because, you know, they were saying how they planted stuff. This group was saying that, and other people say that they plant stuff and then they find it, which I can believe, but there's no way of knowing these things because of the way they go about it. They let him leave, and then they said after he left, said later that they found this stuff there in that garage. Anyway, these are all these things that you'd want the defense people to be making noise about, but so far you don't hear a word from them. So I think what happens is that the prosecution presents its entire case, which is going to take forever, and then the defense comes back and presents their case, something like that. So we don't have any objection to any of this stuff. Now the rest of it I'm just going to let go. Boy, there's a lot here. Brother, I think it's so much, but okay, I'm going to move on now, although I might be giving myself more time than I'm going to be able to fill up, but I'm going to move on to talking now about Mark Weber and the IHR. And why do I want to talk about Mark Weber? Well, I've been threatening to do so for a while now, saying I want to, and I finally have a space of time, an opportunity to do so. So I thought I should take advantage of it. And why do I keep complaining about Mark Weber? Because so many other people seem to have stopped. They just accept him now as he is. And after all, he's of German ancestry, as I consider myself to be, because I am. But he spent a lot of time in a Holocaust revisionist circles, although he never was an actual revisionist himself, I would say. He was more of a spokesman for it, and he did get on some television shows. He's more like Bradley Smith, although he's more knowledgeable than Bradley Smith, probably in the ins and outs of the Holocaust, but I don't know, but he doesn't, he never really wanted, he doesn't like to talk about it anymore, but he did some kind of revisionist work. He did some in the beginning, but not a lot. And I think some of his articles were actually, you could call them, actual revisionist research, maybe. I don't know where these articles are anymore. But he just never got into it like the real revisionists like Rudolph and Metonio and Graf and, well, I always come up with those three, but there's more than that, who have done the bulk of the work, and some of the earlier ones, too. There's earlier ones. Than that, but I'm not going to go through all those names right now. So, the serious criticism of Mark Weber has come from Guillermo Rudolph and from Bradley Smith and from Frederick Berg, who once supported him, and many other revisionists, and from Michael Collins Piper, who's not a revisionist, but he's associated with Willis Carto and in that whole conflict with the IHR. That's where that comes from. But these others have seriously criticized Mark Weber when he dropped the ball and wrote his article about the Holocaust no longer being relevant, and he didn't think he should spend any more time on it, or the IHR should continue to spend much time on it at all. But he was criticized for more than that. He was criticized for not doing anything. And this is my main criticism of him. The criticism of him being at the IHR and allowing it to go, to become a do-nothing organization. So, with all of this in the background, which I'll go into a little bit, go into it in more detail, but, the question is, should all this be forgiven? Should it be seen as just, well, Mark Weber is an individual. He is, he has a right to be for something, be not be for something, to do this for a while, change his mind, to do something else, and so on. And, there's nothing to blame him for? Or is it, did he have a responsibility to the Institute for keeping it, taking good care of it, keeping it as an active organization? Or if he wasn't going to do so, should he have tried to try to find somebody who would and work with the board and so on and dismiss himself because he was no longer interested in what was the theme it had been, well, what this institute had been created to do? So let's remember that it was in the late 1970s, 79 maybe, or between 77 and 79, that David McAlden had the idea for the Institute of Historic Review Historical Review. And there was a kind of a meeting or a group of people around, talking together. Among them was Willis Carto. That's one of the people I know was there. And he came up, he introduced this idea he had. He said, well, we should have this institute and we should do this and do that. And everybody there who was there present at the time thought it was a good idea and agreed. And so then they had more meetings after that and set this up as the Institute for Historical Review. Now, let me scoot down here a little bit. I should go back to this later. Now, where do I have this? I was asking, what is an institute? And I looked it up to get a clear definition of it. Now I can't seem to find where I have that. It's probably what I already passed by. Be careful I don't jump out of my way again. An institute is, there it is. Okay. The definition of an institute: an organization founded to promote a cause. Or, another one, an organization founded for a particular work, such as education, promotion of the arts, or scientific research. Well, excuse me, what cause is the Institute for Historical Review promoting now and for some time now? What is the cause of the Institute for Historical Review? If I wanted to be sarcastic, I would say the cause was survival and living wage of Mark Weber. I mean, Mark Weber seems to be the only cause of this institute at, you know, for some time now. And the other question, what work is this institute doing? What work is being done there? There's no work being done there. You know, at one time there was tons of work being done there, and through there and channeled through there. And, I think that there are a lot of people new in the movement who think they know all they need to know about it, who do not understand what happened at this place, and think that what it is now as this website online, with a lot of good articles that people can look up and information that was all written in the 1980s and 90s and before Mark Weber, some of it by Mark Weber, but certainly most of it by other people, I would think, before he took over, before he was the one in charge of the place. Other people were in charge and were running it. Mark Weber was helping with that journal, and now I have to say I'm not sure if he was eventually the editor of it, but and he seemed to do all right as long as he had other people there, you know, participating and making him do it. But once that stopped, he stopped putting that journal out on time until finally he didn't put it out at all, and he missed so many issues that he said he made the decision that print journals were no longer feasible. You couldn't, couldn't get enough people to buy it. Well, people had paid for it and they subscribed to it and they weren't getting the issues. You know, they weren't coming, or they were several months late, and then the next one would be even further more months late from that until, you know, they were way behind in what they had actually paid for. And for a lot of them, they never did get the magazines they paid for, and they weren't reimbursed either. But back at the time when it was a real going concern, it was under the leadership of other people. And Mark Weber was just one of the participants there, although he was pretty active with it, and he was pretty active with the revisionists in their trips and travels and so on, and the research they were doing. And he was supposedly writing a book that he never did write, but he got a big advance for it from someone who was a supporter of the IHR, and he kept pretending. Now here's one of the signs of what the problem is with Mark Weber. He kept pretending that he was working on this book and saying that he was working on this book. But when he finally got total, you know, it never showed up, and he never even I don't know if he published a chapter or something from it. That's possible. I don't know for sure, but people finally just, you know, couldn't keep expecting it. And then when he finally took over, there was no book, and he hadn't even done any work on it, really. So, his articles are basically doing a good job of organizing the material that is available and that other people have researched and found out on these various historical issues, and sometimes issues relating to the Holocaust too. And then he's good at that. He's good at organizing this material and putting it forth in a way that people can find palatable and can read. And that's the strength of him. That's his strength. And that's still what he does. And it's still his strength, although he doesn't even do that much, but he does that some in his podcast, or if he goes to be a guest on a radio program. And I'm going to get to this guesting business here after I make sure I've covered this this other. I'll just go right back to these to this part about Weber today in being, should, my question was, should Weber be forgiven for all the failures that he has brought about and for his destruction of the IHR, which I'll get to, I suppose. In my opinion, he has destroyed the IHR. And then the question is, did he do it by his own laziness, or did he do it on purpose? And did he have help in doing it? That, you know, did he have Jewish influence, Jews influencing him, which Michael Collins Piper insists on, and other people suspect, and there's a reason to, that, you know, it's possible. Did he have this Jewish influence and they helped him, in this big conflict with, Willis Carto? Well, I kind of shifted over that, but that's been gone over. But, you know, the revisionists, working at the IHR, they weren't like employed by the IHR, but they were involved in the IHR. They were writing for the journal. They were writing stuff and they were all, you know, actively participating, and they felt that they didn't like the way Willis Carto then was running things, and that, well, of course, it's because this big donation came in, a big contribution, supposedly in the millions, was in the works, and then people got greedy, and then it was that, well, Willis Carto was said that this was going to be in charge of all this money, and he shouldn't be. And it belonged to the Institute, and the Institute was all the people who were participating in the Institute. And they did, Mark Weber became kind of in the center of this. He wasn't the only one, but he seemed to have the time and the desire to, kind of make himself the leader of this, sort of a revolt against Willis Carto. And, then it went, you know, it went further and further. It ended up in a big court case. And in the end, nobody knows what happened to all that money. Mike Piper says he's documented it. He's got, you know, he writes so much that you don't want to have to read through it all to, find out what the bottom line of it all is. So, but it's, you know, this kind of infighting caused nothing to be gained by anybody and a lot to be lost. And so people then go from that to saying, well, never do any infighting, never disagree about anything, just let things go on because it doesn't pay off. Well, this kind of infighting doesn't. And I don't know what people call infighting if you just are critical. Like right now, I am being critical of Mark Weber, and people will say, gee, this is, you know, Carolyn is engaging in this infighting and just doesn't do us any good. If the Jews are laughing at it, I don't think the Jews are laughing at it. That's not what makes them laugh. So, but I don't think so. I think that my question is, how much should we forgive people when they do wrong to the cause, to the movement that they're supposedly supporting? How many chances do you give somebody, really? I mean, when someone has proven that they have behaved badly and done damage to our cause, and in this case, the damage to the IHR has been a huge blow and it's never been really recovered from, because it was a organization that had so much potential and it had such a good start to it. And then, for that reason, you know that the power structure that is against the Holocaust revisionism, which was the main work of the IHR at that time, would be very, very busy in destroying it. And well, you have to look and say, well, Mark Weber was right there in the middle of this destruction, because he won out in the end, and he was the leader of the faction that won. They got the court ordered that all kinds of money over a million. I don't know. I have to go back and look at the records because I forget these things. But over $1 million, several million dollars, whatever, had to be paid back to the Institute from Willis Carto. And Mark Weber was leading he wasn't actually director then, I don't think, but he was in this leading group with a couple other people who were now, you know, had the confidence of the rest of the revisionists to take charge of it. And then slowly, there were a lot of problems. There were a lot of problems, and people dropped out. Often Mark Weber was blamed. Mark Weber was criticized, but somehow he survived through all that. And he was, he ended up, you know, and, let's see. Money was spent. I don't have any of these records here in front of me talking about this, but, because I just want to give the big picture here. So when, with all this going on, more and more was lost. Money was spent on lawyers and so on. And then different of the faction that was in the Mark Weber camp, got disillusioned and got angry, and they got angry at Mark Weber. And they disagreed with his decisions, and instead of staying in there and fighting him, they walked away. They quit. Fritz Berg was one who says he just quit and turned it all over. He didn't want to stay and fight because he didn't want the responsibility himself. I mean, most of these people, they didn't want responsibility. So only those who were willing to take the responsibility, they got it. But then every one of them who was working with Mark Weber at that time will tell you privately that that Mark Weber was the big problem, and that Mark Weber basically destroyed the potential of the IHR. Well, I guess it still has potential, but he destroyed what was being done then. And yet by then he had it so much under his control. By his friends in the board of directors, by convincing the board of directors that he was doing the right things, that he was making the right decisions. Because it all started being based on, well, there wasn't enough money. After all that money that was a part of this whole thing, eventually there was no more money left. And, he had a staff there. There were several people who were being paid. Pretty good salaries. And then they were paying some people to work there. Well, one by one, these things disappeared, and the money that came in kept going down, down, down. And, today, and for a long time now, there's been nobody there but Mark Weber. And Mark Weber has a salary. I mean, they have to, publish their annual statement, and I have some of those. I know where to find them. I could have got those out, but they don't mean much. What you see there is that contributions keep going down, expenses go down accordingly, and now it's a place where there's a board of directors of about four people, where it used to be like six or eight. And that has shrunk too. And all the old people who knew what were cared about the IHR are gone. And all that's on this board are friends of Mark Weber who have admitted and said that they don't know anything about what the IHR does. They don't know anything about revisionism. They don't care about it. They're not interested, but they're just doing this, you know, they're on there as a favor to Mark Weber. So they don't get paid, at least officially they don't get paid. They don't do anything either. And so the whole thing has come down to being simply Mr. Mark Weber sitting there, and he left the big offices and he's in some other place, I guess, but he's still got an office to go to. And he's got a phone and he's got, you know, internet and all this, and it's all paid for. And he's got about, he gets about $40,000 a year, 40, 50. I don't know how he can live on that, but maybe, he doesn't have to live on it, but maybe, he can find more, which is off the books or something, but, that's what it shows on the books. And there's value in the IHR property. There's value in the inventory, that they have still a lot of books that they're selling. But all of this came to Mark Weber through no investment of his own, except for the investment of his time over those years, which other people invested time also. But you'd think that such a mild-mannered, quiet, and kind of a meek type of person would not have had the ability to maneuver and outsmart Willis Carto and outsmart all these other revisionists and end up there, you know, by himself, like the king of the hill. Not a very big hill anymore. It's a shrunken little hill, but he's king of it. And it's reasonable to think that he had some help in doing this, because the desire, and that also the desire of the Jews, has been satisfied. Yeah, he pretends like he's still a threat and they still want to, get rid of him. Well, they probably would like to get rid of the website altogether, but, maybe they take all that in time eventually. And that is a shame, because that, the material on that website is worth a lot. And I was thinking about this and I thought, well, if, what could be done, because people will say, and they will say to me, and they've said it before when I've talked like this, well, if you don't like what Mark Weber's doing, and you start your own institute and make it the way you want it to be. So I thought, well, you know, you could download all those, all that content from the past, of the good revisionist content from the IHR website, and put it up on a new website and start another one. But then I thought, the IHR has a kind of an inheritance of value. I mean, it's got a reputation, and you can't just start something brand new and have it become the same thing as what was started back then and was and could still be. So what really should happen is that Mark Weber, if he cared about the cause rather than his own income source, which he has no, he doesn't want to go out and work even though he's not old, but he doesn't want to go out and work hard enough to make an income. He's got this one. As long as he keeps working at fundraising, which is his main job, that's about all he cares about, is constantly trying to get donations and contributions. And he manages to get them because of the reputation and the quality of the content on the IHR website. He manages to get them because people value it. And now people today who don't know any better think, oh, look at that Mark Weber. He's holding the fort there. He's doing a great job. He's wonderful. We should help him out a little bit. What he's really done is to destroy what was a great thing. And he'll say it's because the Holocaust ran out of steam. It ran out of energy. But it did not. You know, I'm really sorry I'm running out of time already, because I've got a lot more to say. I want to comment that the last times that he was on radio, you know, he gets on these radio programs. And where do I have that? And he had, he was on Truth Jihad sometime this year. And I don't know, they probably just talked to him. He didn't, talk to him as somebody in the white movement. Now, he's not a white nationalist. He'll tell you that. I mean, he'll deny it if somebody calls him that. But he was also on Renegade Broadcasting with Kyle Hunt earlier this month. And he says on there that the victims of Stalin far outnumber the victims of Hitler. And instead of saying that, instead of playing down the victims of Hitler, which he doesn't do, because you see, who were the victims of Hitler? And this Kyle does not know enough about Mark Weber to ask questions. He never asked him any hard questions. He accepted everything that he said, and he praised him. And so that's what they do today, these people. They just praise Mark Weber as though he doesn't have any dark shadows in his past that you should be checking into. Mark Weber says that he made the point an enormous policy of repression and killing of many Jews during World War II. And yet Kyle doesn't say, well, how many Jews you think were killed or anything like that? No, because previously Mark Weber has said millions. He says millions of Jews. And he has said like David Irving that at least 1 million Jews were gassed in the Action Reinhardt camps. But they don't bring this up when they talk to Mark Weber now, as though he's a great fighter for revisionist truth. There's a problem with this, and that's really why I'm talking about it. Another one is Rodney Martin, who's now gotten real buddy-buddy with Mark Weber. And Rodney Martin knows about Mark Weber. He has just decided to make friends with him. But there was a time not so long ago when he was absolutely talking to me about doing shows about Mark Weber and exposing Mark Weber, and he had all the goods on him, and he had nothing good to say about Mark Weber. Well, I didn't either, and we discussed that between us many times, but I had talked about Mark Weber and without Rodney, and Rodney didn't have anything new to add, so I never did a show with Rodney about it. But he was wanting to do it. Well, now he has decided that he's going to be Mr. Bringing Everybody Together, and so he's now doing projects or something with Mark Weber. So this is the way, this is what bothers me, that we don't hold people's feet to the fire. We allow people to get away with things and come back again to do it another time, you know? We allow people to be treacherous to our cause. And then after a while, because we don't want to be unkind and we don't want to be divisive, and then they'll say, well, there's not that many of us. So, we need to pull together. We don't need to attack one another, never attack one another. That's Rodney Martin's new thing. And therefore, these people get back in and they never pay and for what they've done, and they never have to answer for it. And the worst thing about Weber is that he will not answer for anything. He's extremely evasive, which Bradley Smith found out when he was trying to get some answers from him back when he first wrote that essay. Well, I have run out of time, ladies and gentlemen, and I guess I should do a whole show about it sometime and have a guest. And maybe I should get Mark Weber to come on. Think you would? All right. Have a great Thanksgiving, and I will see you in December. Bye.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.